You're a bright young man. This monkey business is in your blood, under your skin. You're not getting out, you're just getting in. You're only getting started. I've every faith in you. And one day in the future, it'll be you sitting here in my place, telling some young Turk the facts of life.
And they are, Mr. Temple.
You're born, you take shit. Get out in the world, you take more shit. Climb a little higher, take less shit. Till one day you're up in the rarefied atmosphere and you've forgotten what shit even looks like. Welcome to the layer cake, son.
Hello, welcome back once again to another episode of the Filing Law Audiobook Archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, the story of American public life from 1870 to 1920, and it was written by Richard Franklin Pettigrew, the first senator from the state of South Dakota. The book was originally published early on in 1922, and it was later republished again at the end of 1922. Now, at first it was self-published, and later it was republished by Charles H. Kerr and Company. And these are essentially the memoirs of the senator and what he found and learned during all his time in public life. In the Congress, where he didn't play ball really with the big trusts and magnates and the people who he calls the rulers of America. He didn't really like to play politics like that. And he didn't make many friends while he was in Congress. And this is the story of America and how the government really works, at least according to this man. Now, the reason why this book is so interesting, in my opinion, is, it's because it comes from what you could consider an authoritative source. Now, Pettigrew isn't a writer, he's not a journalist, he's not a historian, or anything like that. He was a man who became senator when the state of South Dakota was inducted into the Union. And so he writes at it like that. He comes out with his guns blazing. He's not afraid to name names and talk about people taking bribes and the way the businesses actually work and pull the strings in America. He's not reserved. He's not bashful. He just comes out and, well, he calls it like he sees it. Now, whether it's all true or not, you'll have to come to your own conclusions. Obviously, if he got into the halls of Congress, he certainly knew how to play the game, but some of the stuff in here is quite interesting. And, it's an interesting insight to kind of see inside how things work, how the people thought, what he saw were the problems with America, because he, in the very introduction for this book, he already identified the fact that during his time in Congress, he could tell that there was a war between what may be traditionally thought as our Republican form of government, and the big businesses and corporations and the emerging trusts and conglomerations of wealth. He said very clearly that there was a war between these two groups. And he said during his time in office, he saw the traditional Republican form of rule, which we're all told that we follow still to this day. He said he saw that lose to the business interests. And so it's kind of interesting to get an insider's thoughts on exactly how and why and when, well, you know, where we lost, essentially. And it's been pretty interesting so far. He's covered a wide range of topics, starting with the economic power at home. So we went under, we've already well covered the interests that dominate the government, in his opinion. And now we're looking at the machinery of government, how it works, the players, the actors, the dominating influences and power inside the government, and pretty much the way the wheels turn, how the skids are greased, this type of thing. And it's been pretty interesting so far, especially the last couple chapters when we looked at, you know, the dominating interests who made the Constitution, and in Pettigrew's view, the evolution of America into some kind of, oh, I guess you'd say, oligarchical fascist state. Well, he concluded that was the natural evolution of the system set in place by the drafters of the Constitution. And then the last chapter on lawyers, the people who he says are the pliable tools and always will be of perpetuating what he calls the English aristocracy, which our country is founded on. And I think he makes a pretty interesting case for that. How they've always controlled, or at least during his time, I should say, they controlled 2/3 of the Congress. And these lawyers were essentially the tools of the big businessmen, or their agents. And one of the most interesting things I thought was that a lawyer, he says that a lawyer is trained on precedent. And what is precedent but keeping the status quo? And I think there's a lot of power and truth in that. So we're going to get right into it this time. And continue on here, of course, before we get into the book. As always, I will be attempting to keep this podcast recording down to about 1 hour in length for easy digestion and consumption of the material. It looks like with this chapter, we're going to be able to do that. It's a short chapter, so. Also, I will be spelling any last names because I tend to butcher the pronunciation of them. And that way you can go online and look these people up maybe a little easier than trying to guess, well, how's this guy's name spelled? It's just something I do. You know, you're just going to have to deal with it. Also, I'll be reading any footnotes into the book. Unfortunately, in this book, there really haven't been any footnotes. It's pretty much a memoir, so it's not a real academic text. But I've been including in this book any charts that Pettigrew put in the work. So if I mention, hey, there's going to be a chart, you can always go onto the website, which is currently located at fileandclaw322.wordpress.com. Or just in case I have to move the website again, I would always recommend as the backup, you can go onto Twitter. My profile is at fileandclaw322. And from the profile, you can find a link to wherever the website will currently be at. So, that would be what I recommend. So if I say, hey, there's a chart in the book, I'm usually not going to read that because it just make it confusing. But you can go onto the website and look at that chart. Or you can also go online and download a copy of this book. It's available for free. I'm pretty sure it's in the public domain. You can find it on archive.org. You can find it on my website. Google Books probably has it. All the usual suspects for getting old library books is probably a safe bet. So, with all that in mind, let's jump right into the book. Alright, this is part 3, The Machinery of Government, chapter number 12, Politics. Like most American boys, I had been brought up to believe that the United States had a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. My first real impressions, to the contrary, were obtained during my early experiences with Dakota politics. There I learned how the machinery of government is manipulated in the interest of those who are behind it, and I learned something about the manipulators. Carpetbag officials, as we used to call them, held the important offices in Dakota while it was still a territory. The governors and other territorial officers were appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate at Washington. Frequently, these appointees lived thousands of miles from the territory in which they were appointed to serve, and in many instances, they had never set foot in these territories until they arrived to take up their official duties. A territory is entitled to a delegate in the House of Representatives. The delegate has a seat but no vote. He may sit on the floor, listen to the phrase-makers of the House, watch the proceedings, introduce bills, appear before committees to urge the interests of his territory, and perform such committee work as the House may choose to assign. The delegate may also advise as to the appointment of local people, such as postmasters, and, in some instances, if he is in political sympathy with the president, he may secure the appointment of a citizen of that territory to a federal post such as the land office. That, however, is very unusual. In 1880, I was nominated for the position of delegate by the Republicans of the Territory of Dakota, which at that time embraced what are now the two states of North and South Dakota. It had an area of about 150,000 square miles, with about 30,000 or 35,000 Indians included in its population. When I went to Dakota in 1869, there were only 14,000 people in the whole territory outside of the Indian population. But in 1880, railroads were building all over Dakota, and the population was increasing with great rapidity. After my nomination, I entered actively into the campaign, visiting the small towns and making speeches. Meanwhile, President Hayes had appointed, as governor of the Territory of Dakota, a citizen of New Hampshire named N.G. Ordway, and his last name is O.R.D.W.A.Y., Ordway. During the summer preceding the election, Ordway came out to Dakota and took possession of the office. Ordway had been for 20 years sergeant-at-arms of the House of Representatives, but in 1878, when the Democrats got control of the House, he was ousted from his position. Bill Chandler, his last name C-H-A-N-D-L-E-R, who was factotum of the Republican Party for New Hampshire,
secured Ordway's appointment as governor of Dakota so that he might go out there, have the state admitted into the Union, and then become one of the senators. Ah, so it's like a little power play, you know. He's wheeling and dealing, trying to get his boy into the government there, so when it becomes a state, he can slide right in as a senator. You see how that works? Continuing with the book. I watched the governor's actions with a great deal of interest. His attitude towards the people of Dakota was extremely patronizing, and he talked about the people of Dakota as though, in his eyes, they were simply children entitled to his benevolent consideration. I soon found out that he was preparing to carry out the political program that had been mapped out for him. For example, he was reported as being engaged in filling a car with the products of Dakota with the idea of sending it through the eastern states as a means of inducing the immigrants or settlers to come out to Dakota and enter lands on the public domain. Finally, he announced that he had arranged with the railroads to carry this car without charge and had selected certain Dakota citizens to accompany it. It was also stated that the governor had secured some of the very finest samples of corn, pumpkin, oats, and other agricultural products from western Iowa and eastern Nebraska, placed them in the car, and proposed to represent them as the products of Dakota. Well, they can't even be honest about pumpkins and corn and oats. What does that tell you? When questioned about this, he said, quote, "Of course, Dakota is new and agriculture is not far advanced, but we all know that we can produce just such products, and therefore it is proper to represent that we have produced them in order to induce the settlers to come to Dakota and enter the land." Unquote. And this episode disgusted me. And in some of my speeches, I made fun of the governor's antics and alluded to him as the Sioux Chief, because having pronounced the word Sioux as Sioux, and alluded to the town in which I lived as Sioux Fall. Sioux Falls. So anyways, Sioux is of course spelled S-I-O-U-X, and I guess he's pronouncing it as S-I-O-X. It doesn't translate well in text, but I'm guessing he's, you know, he's not from around there. He doesn't know how to pronounce the damn names of the city. He's a carpetbagger. This is what the people had to put up with. Kind of funny. After the campaign was over, I went to Yankton on some business, and Newton Edmonds, who had been governor of Dakota before I went to the territory and who in 1880 was a banker at Yankton, called on me at my hotel and advised me to see Governor Ordway before I left town. This guy Edmonds, Newton Edmonds, his last name real quick, E-D-M-U-N-D-S. All right. Edmonds told me that the governor was very much offended at the allusions I had made in my speeches and had said that unless I came and apologized, he would not issue my certificate of election as a delegate in Congress. I immediately told ex-Governor Edmonds he was a man of excellent parts, of fair ability and strict integrity, that if that was Ordway's attitude, I would rather reaffirm what I had said about him and that under no circumstances would I call upon him, but would leave it for him to decide whether to perform his duty as governor and issue the certificate of election or to betray his office in order to punish a political rival. I added that I rather thought his failure to perform his duty would not keep me from getting my seat in the House of Representatives. Before the 4th of the following March, when I would take my seat in the House, I received my certificate of election from the governor without comment. But I was told by friends in Yankton that the governor remarked when he issued the certificate that he guessed I might as well have it, as I would not amount to anything in Washington. I would be nothing but a wallflower, he said, while he would control the patronage ordinarily granted to a delegate from a territory. Yeah, he's like, you ain't gonna get far, buddy, with that attitude. Not in Washington, D.C., you won't. Continuing with the book. When I finally reached Washington, I found that South Dakota post office appointments were being made on the governor's recommendation. At least one had been confirmed at an Indian agency. I at once insisted that the Postmaster General remove Ordway's appointee and put in his place a man whom I recommended. The Postmaster General was reluctant to do this because Ordway had been very prominent in Republican politics and knew all of the leading men in the nation. He had also been the representative of the predatory interests, the railroads, the public utilities generally, the contractors, etc., about Washington, and he had acted while sergeant-at-arms as their go-between in the purchase of votes and the control of the lawyers who made up the bulk of the members in the House of Representatives. Now we're getting... This guy has some pull. You see, when he was sergeant-at-arms, he was the man, the money man, the bag man who carried the money around to bribe the senators. This was the House of Representatives. My apologies. So I guess it was going on in both houses, right? And it always was. Don't let anybody tell you differently. So this guy's got some pull, right? He was the bag man. He's the money man. He did some favors. Of course, the quote-unquote bribe always took the form of a quote-unquote fee. Because of his intimate acquaintance with their deals, Ordway was feared by the politicians, and the Postmaster General finally refused to comply with my request. Wow, what does that say about politics? That's how it works, folks. That's that House of Cards stuff that you see. Come on, this is how it goes. You got this guy, he's the bag man, he carries the bribe money around to the senators on which way they should vote, their fee. He carries the fee money around to him, right? Because they're lawyers, they can take bribes. Fees. I'm sorry, I keep calling it bribes, I don't know why. But anyways, he carries around the money, and so he knows, you know, who's getting paid what, who got this, who got that. That's a lot of dirt on people. And that is power. And he's leveraging it here. People are afraid of him. Okay, let me get back to the book now. Too much chatting. Here we go. The Post Office Department relies upon a delegate to recommend certain things that should be done in the territory that he represents, and I told the Postmaster General that I certainly would take no part whatever in trying to promote and protect the interests of the government with regard to mail routes, etc., or ever visit his department again unless I was accorded the full recognition which belonged to a delegate, and so the matter rested until Congress convened. When Congress met, I went to Senator Platt of New York, with whom I was well acquainted, told him of the controversy that had arisen over South Dakota patronage between N.G. Ordway as governor and me as delegate, and asked him to have the Postmaster General recognize me as the representative of Dakota instead of N.G. Ordway. Platt at once said, quote, "Yes, you are entitled to that recognition. The Postmaster General is from my state. I suppose I endorsed him for the position, but Ordway has been to see me about this matter, and he is a very powerful factor in Republican politics, besides being very competent as a political manipulator. Now, you are a young man, and he is a man of great experience. Why don't you get together?" Unquote. I told Senator Platt that was very difficult because of the governor's statement that he would not issue my certificate of election unless I would apologize to him for what I had said about him. My reply was that I would never do it. In a day or two, however, Senator Platt asked me if I would receive and talk with the governor if he called upon me. I told him I would, and thereupon I made an appointment through Senator Platt for Ordway to see me at my hotel the next evening. The governor arrived in due time. I took him to my room, and he opened the conversation by saying that he was an old and experienced politician and had been in public life for many years, that I was a young man just starting out, but that I gave great promise for the future, and that he was anxious to form a political alliance with me to take control of the political affairs of the territory of Dakota. He then proceeded, by way of argument and advice, to say that if I would consult him about all my appointments as delegates, he would consult with me about his appointments as governor, and that by thus combining our influence and working in harmony, we could become so strong and influential as to elect each other to the United States Senate when the territory of Dakota was admitted as a state. That's how it really works, folks. Are you getting a getting a good peek here? After he had completed his argument, I said, quote, Governor, this is the first time I have ever met you. I was not impressed by what I knew of you before this meeting. We are here with the idea of perfecting some kind of an alliance by which we can work in political harmony. As things stand now, that would be very difficult. I have a suggestion, however. Suppose you go back to Dakota and attend to your duties as governors while I look after the duties of my office here in such a way as to promote the welfare of the people of Dakota. If you will do that and use your office to promote the interests of South Dakota and its people without consulting me at all, you will become so popular that the people... Nope. I try again. If you will do that and use your office to promote the interests of South Dakota and its people without consulting me at all, you will become so popular with the people and so strong politically that you will easily be the most prominent man in the territory. If you make a good, honest, and capable governor, and I make a good, honest, and capable delegate in Congress, the time will not be distant when we will naturally work together, our common purpose being the welfare of the people. Unquote. The governor did not take to that advice. He had never done anything that way and probably did not understand what I meant. He seemed to conclude that I talked that way because I wanted to make money, so he started on another track. You know, said Ordway, quote, I as governor have the right to appoint the commissioners of every new county that is organized. These commissioners can locate the county seat of the county, and therefore there is always great competition among the citizens of a county to secure these appointments so that they can locate the county seat town. You know there are a great number of new counties being organized every year all over Dakota. Now, if you and I will go in together, we can so manipulate the organization of these counties as to get part of the land upon which the county seat is located, or else we can make the people pay high who have land on which they want the county seat located. Besides that, there is something even bigger. People want a new capital city for the territory. By uniting together, we might easily arrange to move the capital from its present location at Yankton to some more central location and make a fortune out of building the new city. Unquote. I let the governor go on developing his whole scheme together with his method of achieving it. He seemed very enthusiastic and acted as though he were well satisfied with himself and with the impressions that he had made. But when he had finished, I said, quote, The territory of Dakota is about 400 miles square, but it is altogether too small for both of us. Either you will have to get out of it or I will. I will never have anything to do with you, but will fight you as long as you remain in the territory. You're the most miserable, corrupt scamp that in my brief career I have ever come in contact with. Unquote. The next morning I called on Senator Platt and told him, in detail, just what had occurred. Platt made no comment except to say that he would have the postmaster removed that Ordway had appointed and would ask the postmaster general to put in whomever I recommended. Upon inquiring with regard to the governor and his career at sergeant-at-arms at the House, I found that when the Democrats had got control in 1878 and had removed Ordway from the position as sergeant-at-arms, they had appointed a committee to investigate the conduct of the office of sergeant-at-arms under Ordway's regime. The conduct of the investigation was in the hands of Glover, his last name G-L-O-V-E-R, who, I think, was from Missouri. I thereupon secured from Glover a copy of the testimony taken by the committee and of the report that the committee had made to the House. The testimony showed that Ordway was the person who carried the funds that were used to persuade the members of the House to grant privileges to the few in order that they might rob the many. That custom has been continued ever since at Washington in both houses of Congress. Bam! There you go. I mean, we all know. It's not shocking, but it's like, hey, here's a senator of the United States telling you this. This should be this is... This should put up red flags everywhere. A senator is telling you yes. You know, they carry around money to bribe people. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. It happens all the time. It's happened ever since. And I guess we could probably assume it still happens in one way or another, right? Maybe the sergeant of arms doesn't really carry around a bag of money anymore, but you know how it goes. Come on, guys and ladies. All right, here we go. Continuing now with the book. While I was in the Senate, Aldrich, of Rhode Island, who was senator, held this important post. Oh, damn. How about that? Good old Senator Aldrich. Nelson Aldrich, who was instrumental, as by old hat, but he was instrumental in, of course, the creation of the Federal Reserve System. A banker's man. He was also the sergeant at arms. Continuing, he died worth, I believe, 20 millions. Others have done similar work. There always are in Washington certain agents of big business employed to look after the attorneys in both houses who are there to represent the great industrial, financial, and transportation corporations. The real government! Boom! I also wrote the chairman of the House committee that investigated Ordway, and he sent me the following letter, which I published with a copy of the testimony taken by the committee. From LaGrange, Missouri. July 24, 1881. To Honorable R.F. Pettigrew, M.C. My dear sir, your letter of the 17th came duly to hand. You refer to N.G. Ordway, ex-sergeant-at-arms of the House of Representatives, and at present governor of Dakota Territory, and ask, quote, if he ever answered the damaging evidence taken before your, meaning my, committee to your, my, satisfaction. Unquote. I answer empathetically, no. It was impossible for him to make satisfactory answer. I have no hesitancy in giving it as my opinion, in view of all the evidence developed against him, that he is one of the most corrupt and unprincipled men that ever disgraced and degraded the public service of this country. He's got some stiff competition, let me tell you. Continuing now with the book. I am convinced that he never sought or held an office with a view of being satisfied with its honors and its legitimate emoluments, but to prostrate it to the worst robbery and fraud for money-making. It would seem simply impossible for N.G. Ordway to hold an official position and not taint and disgrace it. He belongs to a class of office-seekers that infest this country now by thousands that should be doomed to destruction by the efforts of all honest men of all parties. I am, sir, your very respectfully, your obedient servant, J.M. Glover. Had the Republicans continued in power, Ordway would have continued to operate in the House. When the Democrats came in, they decided to have one of their own men do the work. Consequently, they staged an investigation which cost Ordway his job in the House, but which, far from destroying his public career, left him free to launch new schemes among men on the frontier. After our... Holy cow, isn't that the way it works, really? I mean, isn't that honestly? You see some guy comes in, he gets busted up, right? Something happens. You're like, oh man, that guy's toast. And sure enough, 5-10 years later, he's back, he's doing something new, he's got a new scheme, new little racket running. I always think about old Ollie North, you know, who got banged up in the Iran-Contra affair. Look at him now. He's totally rehabbed. He's back on, is he on Fox News or somewhere like that? These are shakeups, folks. When there's an investigation of something in Congress, it's a shakeup. They're trying to shake some guy out of some position and some little power play. That's it. This Pettigrew is telling you this. This is the modus operandi. The whole time he was in Congress in the 20s, you think it's gotten any better? Hell no. I mean, this is some hard-hitting stuff here. He's really getting into how the government works. This is fascinating. Let's continue on with the book. After our meeting in Washington, Ordway went back to Dakota and tried his hand at being governor. He entered into a scheme to move the Capitol and then secured the passage through the legislature of a bill establishing a Capitol Commission to go about and receive bids for the location of the Capitol and its removal from Yankton. His purpose, of course, was to locate the Capitol somewhere in about the center of the southern half of Dakota. Alexander McKinsey, last name McKinsey, who lived in Bismarck in the center of the north half of the territory, was a person having very many times the ability of Ordway and was far his superior in integrity, a man of very many powerful parts. He had managed to capture Ordway's Capitol Commission and to locate the capital at Bismarck, which is now the capital of North Dakota. Ordway got nothing out of that scheme, but he was actively organizing new counties all over Dakota, and the air was full of rumors of scandals. Finally, he received $10,000 in money to appoint a commissioner in a county where the county seat location was of considerable importance. This performance was so scandalous and barefaced that he was indicted for bribery and corruption by a grand jury of one of the counties, and his case came up before Territorial Judge Edgerton, my last name E-D-G-E-R-T-O-N, who had been appointed through the influence of Senator Davis of Minnesota. Edgerton was an honest man, or at least more honest than is the rule among lawyers. I do not believe he could have been persuaded by money to violate his judicial oath or any act not in strict accordance with the duties of his office. The governor was evidently very much alarmed. He employed Senator Davis of Minnesota, who had been responsible for having Edgerton appointed judge, to defend him. Davis was not a criminal lawyer, but in those days the fee of $10,000, which Ordway offered Davis, was rather tempting. So Davis went out to Dakota when the case was called, and told the judge that it should be dismissed because the only punishment that could be meted out for crimes committed by a governor was an impeachment and removal from office. The judge ruled that such was the law, and the case against Ordway was dismissed. The episode convinced Ordway that even 160,000 square miles of territory was too small an area for both of us to live on, and so he left Dakota and came back to Washington. However, in 1882, Ordway made the greatest fight of his life to defeat me for the Republican nomination for delegate in Congress. North and South Dakota were already divided, as the people of each half had come to believe that when Dakota ceased to be a territory, it should be admitted as two separate states into the Union. In this campaign, North Dakota put up a candidate, John B. Raymond, last name R-A-Y-M-O-N-D, who was the United States Marshal, a young man of excellent principles who had been appointed by the president and sent out from some eastern state. Raymond carried most of the counties of North Dakota, and they endorsed him for my position. In South Dakota, Ordway put up George B. Hand from Yankton, who had been Secretary of the Territory. He was a man of ordinary intelligence, but he always agreed with everybody and was affable and suave. Hand made a poor showing. I carried almost every county in South Dakota, and I had an almost overwhelming majority of the whole territory. But Ordway contested nearly every county that I carried. He did not try to contest the county in which I lived or the adjoining counties east and west of where I lived. He contested Moody County, where my brother lived, although there were not over 3 members of the county convention against me. But those 3 felt that they had been beaten by fraud. The same practice was pursued in almost all the counties of South Dakota, so that the uncontested delegates from South Dakota, who were controlled by Ordway, united with those which Raymond had from North Dakota and made a majority in the preliminary organization of the convention. They then selected a committee on credentials, a majority of whose members were my political enemies. That committee proceeded to seat all of the contesting Ordway delegates, knowing that my delegates would immediately form another convention and nominate me. This would have split the Republican Party of the territory into 3 parts, and would have resulted in the selection of a Democrat. I went to their candidate, John B. Raymond, from North Dakota, and said to him, quote, You know that Ordway is not a friend of yours, and that if he gets control of this convention, he will not nominate you, although you have united with him against me as a common enemy. Now, if you will agree to have the Committee on Credentials seat the delegates who are elected and were fraudulently contested, I will go into the convention and withdraw as a candidate in your favor. Unquote. If I do, Raymond replied, quote, you will have a majority of the whole convention and can proceed to nominate yourself. Unquote. Of course, I said, quote, you will have to take my word for that. Unquote. Well, said Raymond, quote, if you will have McKinsey guarantee that you will do as you say, and McKinsey is the most prominent man in Republican politics in North Dakota and is my friend, I will take your promise and McKinsey's guarantee and do as you request, unquote. McKinsey promptly agreed to the arrangement, and I then assembled all of my delegates in a room at Grand Forks, a little town in North Dakota, where the convention was held, and told them what I had offered to do. In the interests of harmony, I told them, quote, and for the purpose of rebuking this corrupt carpetbag governor, I think it is the wise thing to do, unquote. They were unanimous in accepting my view of the matter. All of you who were contested will be seated, I said, quote, and we will take control of the party machinery, but the success of the scheme depends upon our keeping it to ourselves. Now there are 140 of you fellows. I don't believe there is a man among you who will tell, unquote. They promised that they would not say anything and that they would carry it out. The Committee on Credentials submitted their report to the convention with a minority report in favor of seating my delegates. When the vote was taken, the North Dakota delegates voted unanimously in favor of the minority report. County after county, as the roll was called, voted this way. Ordway himself came into the convention in great excitement and rushed among the delegates, exclaiming, quote, you're voting wrong. You don't understand what you are doing. You're voting for the wrong report, unquote. But he made no impression. After the vote was announced, I arose in the convention and said, quote, in the interests of harmony and to prevent the disrupting of the Republican Party in Dakota, I conclude that it is best for me to withdraw from the contest. I therefore do so, and I nominate John B. Raymond as delegate to Congress, and thus rebuke this miserable, contemptible, and fraudulent scheme which had been perpetrated by our carpetbag governor, the Sioux Chief. Unquote. Ah, boy. The plan worked perfectly. Not a single one of the 140 delegates had told what was to be done, and the Ordway crowd had no chance to prepare a counteroffensive. Raymond was almost unanimously nominated as territorial delegate to Congress. Of course, a majority of my friends were placed on each of the party committees selected for the convention, and my friends were selected as chairman in all cases. Ordway had had some measure of revenge. I lost my place in Congress, but gained control of the party. The episode lost him both standing and popularity. This story of a political intrigue in a sparsely settled Midwestern territory is not unique. It could be matched, in every essential detail, out of the political experiences of men in every state of the Union. That is why I tell it, because it is so general in its application. But more important than that, I tell it because it reveals some of the forces that were at work underneath the surface of the machinery of government. There was ambition, of course, and trickery, and jealousy, and revenge. But beneath and beyond these personal traits, there were the economic forces that have played so large a part in shaping the government of the United States. The men who exhibited the greatest abilities and who displayed the most faculties were selected and used as the tools and spokesmen of big business. Bribery and corruption were not crimes, unless they became too blatant. Ordinarily, they were businesses in which the capital was furnished by the quote-unquote interests, and the work was performed by officials sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. Later in my political experience, I was to learn that the whole structure of our government, from the Constitution onward, had been framed by businessmen to further business ends. That the laws had been passed by the legislatures and interpreted by the courts with this end in view. That the execution of the laws was placed in the hands of executives known to be safe, and that these things were more true of the national than they were of local and state political machinery. All right, that's the end of chapter 12. And very candid there, but yeah, it's awesome. That's great information. And just think, this is a senator saying this. So you tell this story, right? And people are like, okay, whatever, where'd you hear that? And you say, oh, you know, Senator of the United States told me. Yeah, that's how it works. He wrote a book about it. You can go look it up. Well, yeah, but that's nowadays, you know, of course, that doesn't happen. That never happened in the past. Oh, yeah, well, he wrote the book in 1922. So, what do you think about that? Anyways, there you go. Chapter 12, Politics. Stick around. Next time, we're going to get into Chapter 13. And this is, now we're getting into the heavy stuff. The United States Supreme Court. Next time on Triumphant Plutocracy.
As always, you've been listening to the File and Claw Audiobook Archive presentation of Triumphant Plutocracy, a.k.a. Imperial Washington, by Richard Franklin Pettigrew, the first senator from the states of South Dakota. And as always, this is history that you're not supposed to know about.
I'm your big brother. Life does get tough, no need to stress, hold you back too much. Let's go, I heard they found a solution. We'll hear you be for the revolution. Get rough, no need to stress, keeps you down too much. Wake up, I heard they found a solution. We'll hear you be for the revolution.